And we are back here at the Gods Will Not Save You, The Wire Revisited. Welcome, everybody. I'm Willie.
Hi, my name's Jakob, and this is a podcast where the co-hosts do a deep read of each episode of the hit HBO show The Wire. Still a hit, right? Even though it's season 5.
Yeah. So I know we took a little hiatus in between the seasons, but as always, anchor.fm/thegodswillnotsaveyou/support. If you want to throw us a little money, it's always really appreciated. But let's hit the ground running with season 5, the most controversial season of the series' run. And with the season 5 premiere episode, More With Less.
Yep. And, well, yeah, I wanted to ask this question on our recording as opposed to just continually, telling you how I got to wrap things up today or this evening, but then continue to just talk before we actually can get a chance to record. I was asking, like, wait. Is season 5 like as bad as everyone said it was? Because this episode is pretty damn good. But I am, like I said, a little short-sighted. You're way better at playing the long game. Yeah. So what are your thoughts? I mean, how did we get to that, critique of this season?
I guess this is a fantastic episode. I do think, obviously this is the most controversial season out of all of them. There's some pretty outlandish plot twists. Maybe some of them don't land as well as they were hoping to. Perhaps it could have benefited from, the 12 or 13 episode arc that they were, usually accustomed to, instead of like the truncated 10 episode arc. But in my opinion, it's still better than anything else on television, really. Even George Pelicano said that he kind of took a step back from season 5 and he felt like this was maybe one of the weaker seasons.
That's the reason, then.
Well, and Ed Burns was, I guess, also preoccupied with Generation Kill, and he wasn't working on this as much. So, maybe it could have benefited from some more arguments in the writer's room. But if you will indulge me for a second, I like to just like read a quote from the original Baltimore Sun review of this season.
Okay.
So the headline by David Zurawick. I think that's how you pronounce
Zurawick?
It. Zurawick. It's Zurawick.
Oh yeah. Sorry.
But the headline is "The Wire Loses Spark in Newsroom Storyline," and it's pretty scathing in its criticism. And I just want to give you a little taste. The docudrama genre, which has come under increasing fire in recent years, combines the look of documentary film with the literary license of theater, giving viewers the sense that what they are watching is true, even though facts have been rearranged and actions invented. Beyond blurring fact and fiction and ignoring any sense of proportionality, the genre also telescopes and confuses time. Simon left The Sun in 1995, and his newsroom villains are patterned on editors and a reporter long gone from Baltimore. But Simon presents his story as if it is taking place at The Sun today. Ultimately, the most disappointing aspect of season 5 is that Simon offers such a simplistic critique of media and their effects on mass consciousness. To say that even the most respected newspapers sometimes have ethical lapses will hardly be news to any HBO viewers who have heard of Jason Blair and the New York Times. Newspapers have changed exponentially since Simon left 12 years ago. When he was in the newsroom, cable TV was still considered new media, and most newspapers were at least 5 years away from the realization that they would soon live or die by the internet. Yeah, so...
Thanks for sharing all that.
Sorry. Sorry, my reading was a little fragmented, but just...
You've been sitting on that for like weeks?
Just a little, interesting perspective that perhaps Simon had maybe too much of a chip on his shoulder and was rehashing, old arguments he was having from, 13 years prior at that point. But, still my favorite show ever.
Yeah. So Ed Burns, Pelicanos, they all took a step back. So in reality, it's like, what actually happened? Did he say like, hey, I need this. I need it. Like he's McNulty on the case, like against Marlowe,
Yeah. Or he's Gus. I mean, that's, I feel like that's his avatar this season for sure. Like we've theorized that maybe McNulty is a little bit of Ed Burns or Prez Bielewski in the classroom.
This is him.
Maybe. Who knows? We'll never know.
Well, yeah. Yeah, so great stuff. You pretty much, laid that good stuff out. Normally, we also like to talk a little bit about, you kind of talked about a lot of the themes, but they do run a bit, like they're counterpoints to, David Simon, people say we didn't hash out the whole like internet storyline and the impact on the news. And he's like, we did, in this episode, we talked about how, it's like, blah, blah, blah. I don't know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. He's always, for any like criticism that people have of David Simon's storytelling, he always has like a really verbose rebuttal that I feel like kind of bodies the opposition.
Yeah, so I don't know what he had to say to David. No. didn't he just retire? Yeah, I think we talked about that. Anyway, so more with less. I mean, What do you want to talk about first here? The cops dealing with that or,
this opening interrogation scene with Bunk and not Deshaun Fredericks.
No, that's someone who got shot, apparently.
But Bunk is working behind the scenes with Ed Norris, Crutchfield, and Jay Landsman to do this faulty lie detector test with the copy machine. Going with the tradition of the season opener is kind of like laying out the theme at large for, what they're trying to convey in the storyline for the respective season. And, the truth is not always what it seems. The bigger the lie, the more they believe. That's, taken from the opening quote, blah, blah, blah. They did a phony copy machine test. So
shady Ed Norris. But, how long have we been locking up these kids with, telling them lies, not letting them seek counsel? Oh, years. Works every time.
And that line, like, oh, sorry, what were you going to say?
Oh, I'm just going to start yelling random, like, the big lie.
But I was reading some comments on the internet and they were,
really?
there was some theorizing that this little exchange between Bunk and Ed Norris, like, how long have we been doing this? Over 20 years, like, that could also maybe be like a subtle reference to like this story with the copy machine originally being referenced in Homicide the Book, which was like close to 16 years ago at this point, or like, 15 to 20 years ago at this point. And it was also used in the show that they're always kind of like
lying.
Yeah. And, David Simon has always been kind of good at like depicting the moral gray area and stuff like that.
I mean, yeah, we don't need internet comments to know this stuff. I mean, it's from Detroit too, right? I think that's what he, like, people got in trouble in Detroit in like the early 80s for doing something like this.
Yeah.
But I can't remember. I mean, I'm sure it was, at, like, commonplace.
Yeah.
Slumlord.
It's funny, like when I first watched this was again like one of the scenes where I was like, okay, this is a little too fanciful. They're taking liberties with like the whole reality of it, but lo and behold, like this is like actually a tactic that they used and was referenced in the book.
It's in the book. And yeah, like it's not that creative at the end of the day, the show, it's all probably happened, good or bad, mostly bad.
Yeah. Some other, things that are, or other themes that are kind of, touched upon in this episode, cheating.
You're gonna read. I mean, that's just something I just had to. I was listening to the talk David Simon did like pretty soon after this show was, you know, was completed, and I think it was at USC. Whatever. Oh, it was about the journalism. It was just kind of like an overview of this season, the show. So that's where he talked about, you know, it's like kind of feedback from the audience, or they're asking questions, and he was just being like David Simon. Like, oh, you think you know what this season's about, huh?
Yeah,
like, he was like cheating.
Yeah,
people are making things up. He's like, okay, well, you know, some like smart journalists I knew like got back to her like, oh, ha ha ha, it's what's not said.
Yeah, exactly. It's like the storylines we've been following throughout these past 4 or 5 seasons,
yeah,
don't even make the headlines in, you know, what is supposed to be the arbiter of truth in the city.
Exactly. Yeah. And then he also quoted like Thomas Jefferson, and now I've canceled him. No, he was just saying like, oh, you know, Jefferson said you'd rather have like a country with, you know, no government and newspapers than the latter, so, or like than the opposite.
Right.
Canceled. Yeah, so they're doing hella surveillance, like,
yeah,
but no one's getting money, no one's getting paid.
Yeah.
Then yeah, I mean, let's see. Anything, you know, you want to talk about on that?
Well, it's just, I think it's quite funny that, that we had been like talking earlier on in this project about like how we feel like it may be like a bit of a stretch that when the cops are doing their surveilling of the criminals doing their deeds, it's like, how are they not like being caught taking pictures and looking through binoculars? And with this episode, Marlo is kind of like hip to that game, and like he's like, Marlo and Chris are pretty aware that they're being watched at all times, so they're extra careful. And I thought it was interesting that in the commentary, Joe Chappelle, the director of this episode, was talking about like how this was one of the few times they didn't have to like cheat with the location, that like, oh, you know, the criminals might be doing their thing over here, but when the cops are taking their pictures and surveilling, we had to like cheat it with another location, but everything was pretty like spatially within the same realm for this shoot. So
I want to talk to Joe about that cheating and locations. Now
yeah, go ahead, go off, man.
No, it's just funny because they you know, they're doing their like little game following the kid on the bike, and yeah, you know, he's northbound on Fulton, which is, you know, a street that's used all the time, like the playground supposedly there where Randy, you know, led little Kevin, and then blah 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 blah. So it's like, oh, you know, we're still in the west side, but then obviously you see like Federal or Oliver and these main thoroughfares on the east side where they're still filming, because yeah, it's easier, you know, hey, more power to them. But you know, like, the bigger the lie, right? It's like geo fake trout. Sorry, I'm not believing this big lie. No, nah, it's good though.
No, but the, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's good. That's interesting. And Marlo's smart.
Yeah. Is this also kind of like a meta commentary on like the whole thing with the, you know, the people having to suspend their disbelief that McNulty wouldn't get caught taking pictures, that Marlo is just like really aware of it, like, oh, this is just like course correcting for some earlier inaccuracies.
Maybe.
No, no, no.
Yeah. But, so what's up with all the like talk about pay and like the cops have it so bad? Yeah. I mean, Are you doing that for yourself? I can read, you know. Thank you. Willie's highlighting everything on the monitor we're utilizing because his laptop, supposedly the screen wasn't working, but I think it was just a ploy to get home field advantage because now he needs to hook it into his large like TV monitor or, you know, his flat screen.
Nah.
That's, you know, it's nice, but not that nice. Don't, if you know where he lives, don't come and steal it. But
yeah, this
it's
is
helpful. It's helpful.
Yeah. I mean, the whole thing with the police department being underfunded is pretty fraught topic considering the current zeitgeist with a lot of countercultural movements concerning police reform.
Why they lost in Virginia, the squad, defund.
Oh my God.
Nah.
Okay, Jake Tapper.
Yeah, this is all that rhetoric.
Sorry. No. Yeah, so you were saying that you feel like it's hard to feel bad for the police.
Yeah. I mean, you know, like Bobby Brown seems like a, you know, whatever, like he'll kick your ass, but he's like a stand-up dude. He's not taking shit anymore, you know?
Yeah.
And like, you know, just hook him up with some crab cakes and a case of Heineken and you can keep him happy, but for only so long. Like this stupid, like, you know, I mean... You know, in the context of, okay, these guys are like, you know, they're showing up to their job, even though they're cops and they're not getting paid. That's like a government shutdown, like instead of, you know, like the context isn't what like people are talking about nowadays, obviously, because that's like whole more nuanced topic of defunding the cops. But I'm just saying like it's ironic because you literally have headlines, although this was recently and The Wire's not real life.
Yeah.
You know, this was supposedly, was it in the 90s? Like with Simon's gripes, like you, you know, talked about, like, you know, what time frame are we in? That's always the question. Like, you know, this is the mid 2000s, but literally just earlier this year, Baltimore officers have a practice of picking up overtime shifts while on paid vacation to make double the money, according to a report Wednesday from the city's inspector general. So. Yeah. You know, this is like, it probably evens out, right? I mean, it's like, have I been doing overtime? Like, you know, you're up, you're down. I guess more consistency would help even out some of the problems in the city, but I don't know. It's just, you know, it's whatever.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, this episode is laying out like a pretty brilliant, argument for like cause and effect with Tommy's like wounded sense of pride that he wouldn't take the bailout from the governor to take care of the schools. The last problem, now he has to like kind of juggle both of these problems, and it is like hard not to it's hard to dispute, you know, when you see the patrol car with like the broken rear view mirror and the messed up bumper and the major crimes unit being disbanded and, you know, not being able to go after mass murderers and shit like that. So I don't know. I'm very pro, like, I don't want people to think I'm a bootlicker or anything. Like, I'm not.
You got a refund, man.
It's funny. There's somebody in my neighborhood literally has a sign on their lawn that says refund the police. Thank you for putting your life on the line or something like that. So.
Yeah. I've seen I drove past the local precinct and saw the like hoopties that they're patrolling your city streets in. It's rough. But hey, Governor Hogan is like on a mission to refund the police currently in Maryland. So.
Yeah, so they can get more overtime for paid vacation or whatever.
Yeah, so Wayne Jenkins can clock overtime from a penitentiary while he has jail food.
Or maybe Barlow could...
Yeah, they're going to have to put up drywall. What? He's been doing this in season one.
I know, he's been doing all the freelance contracting work.
Yeah, we got to put a cap, 10 hours on the moonlighting. So, you know, it's like, they're not going to have any, like, energy for real police work. It's like, what? Barlow's been grinding out there with pressure treated way over 10 hours a week.
He needs a price for pressure treated.
So you just want to talk about City Hall, a.k.a. Shitty Hall?
Nice. Yeah. Well, before we move on to that, like, can I just the whole thing with Officer Bobby Brown, like, he was the one of the like main foils to like the drug addicts in the corner.
Yeah, he's like,
but he was okay, but it's like another one of those, you know, Jay Landsman, Delaney Williams, Dennis Mello things, because the actor Bobby Brown plays Bobby Brown in The Wire, but Bobby Brown is also in the corner, but he plays a different character, and he plays Officer Ira Wiener, and an actor named Brian O'Neill plays Bobby Brown. So, like, what the fuck is up with this? What is up with all this, like, musical name switcheroo type charades? I don't know.
He wasn't good enough back then to be himself until he found his, like, true, like, they're just like, dude, get drunk this season, Wire. Like, just be you, man.
Yeah, I don't know.
Have a fist fight.
And that fist fight, whoo, man.
Is that like an inspiration for True Detective's fist fight?
I don't know. They seemed way more capable of handling them. The fist fight in this scene looked like it was pretty messy.
Yeah, but I mean,
pretty
like,
choreographed.
Yeah, I just think it's like, these are like A-list actors, and then Bobby Brown's like way too hood to be like going through all this blocking. He's just like, man, like, let me fight her, like, whatever, you know? You know what I'm saying, man? No, fuck that, man. I'm a hood-ass white dude, man. South Baltimore. I'm from Pigtown, man.
It's so crazy. He was in like a legit actor on the corner, but they mentioned that he was like an extra starting out in The Wire. So like he got demoted.
Yeah. Wait, so that's the real, that's really Bobby. That's the cop. He's a cop.
No, I don't think, I think Bobby Brown is.
Oh, Bobby Brown is his, like, he's an.
Yeah, so
that's not the real Bobby Brown. That's
so the real Bobby Brown from the corner is a real cop.
Yeah,
but then the guy in the show
is named
Bobby Brown, and he's also playing the cop Bobby Brown.
Okay, got it. So it's like, Jesus.
Yeah,
that's fucking. That's like crazy. That's like beyond Frank Reed, like fake Reed and fake Frank Reed.
I know.
The
rabbit hole.
Okay, so
yeah, let's move on to, as you so brilliantly dubbed it, Shitty Hall.
Shitty Boys. Leading into, well, I don't want to spill the beans on your like passion project Beyond the Wire. That's why you're like, we got to do like two a days, get this season Boo Boo 5 done with so I can get to the real stuff. Carcetti. Is he like, and the arc of his character.
Nah.
And compared to maybe another mayor in the Wire sphere.
Simulation.
I'm excited though.
But yeah, Burrell and Rawls basically kick things up the chain of command to the mayor and say, you know, things are real bad in the department. And one thing we can do is disband this major crimes unit because we're not making any headway on these 22 murder investigations. And one thieving politician trumps 22 dead bodies. Good to know.
Shit. Lance will make him dance. You can't do that. Yeah, so, you know, pretty clear statement there.
Yeah.
Like, people matter less and less each day, you know?
Yeah. And, like, it's a, if you thought that, like, the whole thing with Carcetti refusing to take the Republican governor's money for the school was the last we would see of his wounded pride concerning like these partisan issues, then you have another thing coming, because a U.S. attorney shows up and says, like, you know, we could, you know, the federal agents can help out with this murder investigation as long as you take Clay Davis national or federal or whatever that means. I'm still not sure exactly.
Hand him over.
Yeah. But
instead of Bond, like, trying to just make his run for, like, attorney, like, state attorney general of Maryland. Like, state versus local.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, state versus federal.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean,
it's like
True Blue.
It's like one of those classic conundrums or whatever, where everybody is just equally fucked up because, you know, the U.S. attorney is holding his cards tight. Like, well, we want to put a Democrat on display and, like, you know, show him that he's the real, like, shitty politician. And then Nerys is like, well, this is going to, you know, affect my chances for mayor because Clay Davis, blah, blah, blah. I don't know. Like, everybody is just, yeah. Everybody's got a game to play. The only person that's not in the room who has, like, any sort of conscience regarding this stuff is Norm.
So. Yeah, he's finally like, yeah. don't be a weak ass mayor of a broke ass city. Wow. My toe. I don't know. Yeah. It's funny how they're like, he's dying. I mean, it's about his own ego, but, you know, the irony that it's Clay Davis that he's deciding to draw the line over. Like, I mean, if there's anyone who represents, like, a rebuke of the, like, two-part, like, any type of party, you know. He's the party of money and Clay Davis. Yeah. So it's like, no, these Republicans.
Yeah.
Screw you. Pointless. I don't know. I can't talk. I'm, like, struggling to talk politics today.
No, I get what...
time, you know.
I get what you're saying, though.
Brilliantly laid out. Like, you know, greatest show, man.
Yeah. Carchetti should have never gotten in bed with Clay Davis in his last minute push to get him over the edge to win the mayoral seat, because this, you know, a season later is having long lasting ramifications or bad consequences effects that he's having to juggle all these balls.
Can't shake him.
Yeah.
Juggling. Yeah, so what else, man?
Do you want to go? Yeah, let's move on to the newspaper stuff, and then we could finish with Marlo, you think?
Oh, yeah. Let's just keep it going, you know.
Yeah.
Papers, a.k.a. the Dooms Room.
Nice, man. You're really good with these puns today.
Well, technically, it was actually several days ago, which it was nice to finally receive this document ahead of time. Damn, dude.
But yeah, this is, it's a new season, so we get a whole new cast of characters. And this is when we are introduced to the colorful cast of characters at the Baltimore Sun.
Who are Gus and
Bill Zorzi.
Yeah. Well, that was him there again, or no?
Yeah, but yeah, Bill Zorzi.
Damn.
An actor named Spry, I think.
Spry. All right.
There's some shady editors. Managing editor Thomas Klebanow, played by David Costabile.
Yeah.
You might recognize from Breaking Bad.
Yeah, he's he's in chemist. Two of the greatest shows ever.
Yeah, exactly.
How rare is that?
I know, right? There's executive editor James C. Whiting III, played by Sam Freed. I think those two characters were probably based on composites of David Simon's enemies in the newsroom.
Yeah,
for sure. But yeah, you want to talk a little bit about how they kickstart this whole narrative?
How are you going to choose 23-year-old model thin, long hair having journalists, editors, when you got someone named Spry right there? They're like, oh, look at us, grizzled reporters here. We know this city. We've been to the, you know, whatever, the Rewrite Man, Jay Spry.
No. Played by Donald Neal.
Yeah, we've been to the dive bars. We know what's going on. We don't just stand around when there's a fire, yeah. You know, which is like a metaphor for journalism and the yeah. newsroom being, yeah. you know, a disaster. It's on fire. So, yeah, you know, it's like kind of not complicated. Well, for me a little bit, you know, the buyouts and the layoffs, and David Simon kind of, you know, very succinctly kind of explained this in that talk that I
yeah.
referred to, kind of my only preparation. Like I haven't even picked up anything, but, you know, kind of just trickles like the whatever, just rolls downhill with the larger,
right.
you know, publishers eating out the smaller ones, like the right. Sun does that to the county papers, and then the LA Times buys the Sun, and then the most evil of all, the Chicago Tribune, comes by. So
yeah,
just one deep state rag after another,
and they have to get rid of their transpo reporter.
Yeah, no more transpo, and
they can't do stories on a desegregation at the University of Maryland because
yeah.
Executive editor James C. Whiting III knows the dean of journalism there. And yeah, even though he's a white guy, he's, you know, got a great character, and he could attest to the fact that they're doing great things for their black students and faculty. So they're just cutting all kinds. They literally are doing more with less. They're just cutting all kinds of corners to, you know, escape the responsibilities of being a real newspaper.
Yeah, and like that's a good point where Simon talked in that. I know I keep talking about this, but he made some great points, obviously, like the usual. I mean, back then, of course, this was like 2000. This is like, you know,
2009,
10. Yeah, like
pretty soon after
some of his Twitter takes, you know, but he was on one then, like he was on it. No, but he was saying how they cut the like poverty desk. And then now it's like that would actually cover, you know, the poor people of color, the poor black people, brown people in the city. And it's been replaced by a nonprofit desk. So it's like Whiting seems like he'd fit into the, you know, nonprofit. Like, no, like white people are doing great things to support people of color, you know?
Yeah.
So maybe that's an example of that playing yeah. out in real. In the show.
Yeah.
But that's who else makes a cameo? Man, you're on it.
Oh yeah, so in that scene where they find the burning building and Gus is like, "Well, you know, are you guys yeah. going to do anything about it?" One of well, the only woman standing in the room making any sort of comment about it is a former Baltimore Sun journalist and current David Simon wife, Laura Lippman. So this is that's great, you know, she did a good job.
Laura Lippman.
yeah, man, fuck. If there is any season where if there's any season that David Simon is fucking over the average viewer, I feel like this is the one, because yeah, like all this jargon and terminology, the E-dot deadline, below the fold.
Yeah.
Blah, blah. I can't even remember some of the. Apparently, the E-dot deadline is the deadline for inclusion of a story in the second edition of the paper.
Great stuff. This this season, this show actually kind of inspired me. Like, I joined the the school newspaper where I went to college. Like,
oh, nice.
Pretty much my last. Well, it was also like, I have no idea what I want to do with my life. I'm pretty much still there. But, it's like, I got to do something. Like, it's my last few quarters here. And, oh, yeah, The Wire, that was great. I'm gonna try out journalism. Like, so yeah. I did it. But,
hey, know, man.
I couldn't, like, get the what was it, like, Richard Price made fun of David Simon, like, at the end of the day, he's like a junkie, like, he, like, he'll have to, like, hop a fence to, like, report on a fire, or, like, a homicide, like, it's like hitting the pipe or something, you know? Yeah. And now it's like TV's kind of trying to replace that, like, gotta get that rush, you know?
Yeah.
It's like the deadline, did this and that. But it is, I mean, that was like, you know, it's a weak ass comparison, but, you know, kind of like, I could feel like you're out there. Also, that was like the year of like some Occupy stuff on like where I went to school.
Yeah.
In Santa Cruz, you know, it was like pretty intense at times. Yeah. So I was like, oh yeah, man. Like, oh yeah. Now if I could just go like walk around the hood here, like what's the equivalent of that? Like maybe I could like get some real stories going, like.
There you go.
Get
man.
My police scanner.
That's no. Great stuff.
I never man. Did that. I never did that.
But yeah, I mean, George Pelicanos mentioned in All the Pieces Matter that he was like so inspired by people coming up to him and telling him like, oh yeah, man, like I joined the Peace Corps because of The Wire. Like maybe you're a byproduct. Like you joined school newspaper because
yeah. And then I got to write about stories like. That no one read and like, but now they're classic. No.
Hey man, you're the Gus or Alma of the UC
Thank
of
you.
The banana UC Santa Cruz banana slug journalistic.
Yeah.
City
on a hill, more like city on a pill.
But, speaking of, you know, the whole thing with like, this TV show being more than just a TV show and in, like inspiring people to, you know, do other kinds of things with their life and stuff. We talked a little bit about, you know, Michael K. Williams starting his nonprofit and stuff. So, Anwan Glover and Wendell Pierce, Sonia Son, Tom McCarthy.
yeah. This is, I've been waiting for this.
Scott Templeton, for some reason, he's like one of the most hated characters in like the entire show's run. Definitely has a very punchable face. There's a quote that I wanted to bring up. This is from an interview in Vulture with David Simon. Somebody, Tom McCarthy said that at one point someone had come up to him on the street and said, "You're a bad man. You're a bad man." So like the Scott Templeton like effect kind of followed him everywhere. And he got like a real like taste of what rotten journalism was. He is kind of like based on a composite of different people from history, including Jim Hayner. And Jason Blair, who was a New York Times reporter who told a lot of lies about the DC sniper, and Jack Kelly from USA Today, who I guess David Simon had worked with at one point and knew that he was lying. So, like, I feel like since Tom McCarthy played like such a despicable character who is so universally hated, that he felt like he had to atone for that. And go on to make an Academy Award winning film about really good journalism called Spotlight, which was all about the Boston Globe's investigation into the sex abuse scandal with a Catholic priest. So this is like Tom McCarthy's response to that kind of vitriol. He's like, I'm going to show people that like I know what it makes a good journalist. So it's interesting.
That's crazy. I never would have known that. No, I mean, I watched that movie like without ever, you know, it's just I feel like I become more and more withdrawn, like less and less that I watch is like, you know, somehow tied to The Wire. So it's like it's like to watch something like a movie standalone, like, oh, this isn't anything in that universe or about that subject matter,
right?
Oh, it's just like, oh, this is pretty cool. I mean that's kind of dumb me to say because like it's about journalism, but I'm just saying
it's quite a bit different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a great movie. I mean, it's really good and never would have known that. I totally spaced out on that. So.
No.
Great stuff, man. And also you taught me a good lesson that you don't just need like George Pelicanos to join the Peace Corps. Yeah. Just having a punchable face can lead to it too.
So what else do we want to talk about in this, journalism storyline. I know you have a lot of interesting details.
Yeah, so they first of all, so they break a story, or Gus notices a little tidbit from, you know, kind of like one of these complex, you know, story to press newsroom, you know, bits about the, what's his name, the guy who's like at the city council meeting.
Jeff Price,
is he, that's the reporter, Jeff Price. So he's on a story, right?
Yeah.
And then, you know, like Gus like knows as a detail that there was some zoning hearing for Ricardo Hendricks, and he knows exactly who that is. That's Fat Face Rick, and he's a known drug dealer, kind of also hammering home the point of, you know, these are the type of guys that we're losing in the newsroom, people who know the city. You know, he just like picks up this very nuanced detail. Obviously he's been on the beat well before he probably, you know, made it to being an editor and higher up. So, you know, it's like, this is what's lost, Willie. If you don't have people like Gus around, you're not going to pick up like the little Fat Face Rick, reference. So that turns into like a pretty crazy, pull, right?
Yeah,
where they're
definitely
doing real journalism and like exposing Norris Campbell for getting in bed with these shady, like drug dealing, you know, developer types. And, he's making like $1 million off of this, deal because he has to, you know, get paid out by the city, and it's all like kickbacks and crazy shit. But it's like very, you know, similar to a classic Kenny Bird story. Kenny Bird Jackson, who was like a little Melvin Williams lieutenant, known in the narcotics trade, had like crazy long rap sheet. And we've talked about a lot on this show already, podcast, whatever, because of his involvement and kind of being like who Stringer like aspired to be but never was able to actually like manifest into, like, so he actually was deeply entrenched, Kenny Bird, in the political you know classes, and got like, you know, like he was donating to all the campaigns and stuff. You know, like Lawrence Bell, and had a like Van Smith like report a lot on him, even though I feel like some of his angles are a little like like, this is Baltimore, these like piece of trash drug dealers, look what they're doing. It's like snarky, whatever. But yeah, he's like has Kwaisi and Fume like pictures above his like desk in his office. But basically the other big parallel, like Fat Face Rick's club Desperados, Kenny Bird had a real club named El Dorado. So like very Western related. Yeah. And this happened like in 2000, I guess, that was like O'Malley was trying to push him out for a huge development.
Right.
I guess in one article that we looked at, it said $54 million Bank of America, like retail space apartment, like, you know, huge development, like the biggest since Inner Harbor type stuff. But then another one says a $48 million. Anyways, it was huge. And then there was all this arguing because Kenny Bird saying that, you know, the family saying that it was appraised for like $625K, the property El Dorado, but the city only wanted to pay out $400, because that was their appraisal. So apparently, you know, he had originally bought it, or the family bought it for $175K. So not $1 million profit like Fat Face Rick is getting here, or trying to get. But, you know, a lot of parallels. So like Clarence Mitchell IV got involved. So that's like when you're like Mitchell's getting involved, that's huge. All the way down, like, that's so crazy that like, I'm Clarence Mitchell IV, and I've like, my dad was like the chief litigator for the NAACP. And now I'm like, if you're, this is what he said, in Annapolis, we have shown the ability to stop whatever needs to be stopped. And like response to, that is Clarence Mitchell. That's in response, like, you know, if you don't treat the Jackson family fairly, like I'll cut funding to your development, O'Malley.
Yeah.
And let it be known, Clarence Mitchell IV did not endorse O'Malley.
That's
so
right.
He's not fake Reed.
Oh, Jesus.
Okay, sorry, Bishop. He's a bishop now. I can't say that. So, but yeah. And then this is what Sheila Dixon said about the whole thing. We need to have a balance with those businesses that have been there, that have sacrificed over the years. So I think that that's also interesting, because someone said in Truth Be Told that Nerys Campbell's like a dead ringer for Sheila Dixon, who like pretty much, you know, came on after O'Malley. And then we talked to, like, at the end of season three, Simon throws like an epic, I don't know, what is that? Like, yeah, it's simulation, because, or is it like, he's like, I'm the king of meta or whatever, which I don't fully understand that, but he threw out like the develop, like the contracting company that was owned by her like boyfriend was like portrayed at the end of season three in Hamsterdam. And then that ended up contributing to Sheila Dixon being brought down on corruption charges. So it's like, oh, Nerys is getting screwed over by Fat Face Rick's like club. And now, you know, on the other side, who she actually like portrays, Sheila Dixon, got wrapped up with Kenny Bird. So it's like, Jesus Christ. So crazy. So anyways, whole lot of shady stuff going on there. But I got to do, we got to look more into some of these articles to see what the hell actually happened with the El Dorado. I think it did end up moving, or like they tried to up, like create an upscale like jazz cafe angle.
Yeah,
and
they're
move.
Trying to do like a supper club or
something. Because that was on the west side, El Dorado, but then it moved to like, they're like, just move to the block, which is like the strip club area. But on the, like in East Baltimore. So, but anyways, yeah, crazy, crazy stuff. Always infinite content from Kenny Bird. Kenny Bird party. Ain't nothing like a Kenny Bird party.
Hell yeah, dude. That's really interesting stuff. Thanks for bringing those post-its of info.
Yeah. I got one left. As you can see, it's, as you can see, this post-it's a lot tinier. So.
Yeah,
that was the good stuff. Yeah. Also, while you were talking about, you know, all those interesting points you brought up about McCarthy and Spotlight, I was like, oh, I wrote down a note. Yeah. I was listening, doing my best. Sorry.
No, it's all good.
I get sidetracked. It's like, oh yeah, I had a sticky note from the first time I watched that. If I would have finished listening to that talk he gave at USC, he mentions another local guy who did that, and like he was writing stories about lead, and his name, I think it's Carol, maybe, and like how, you know, lead like causes, you know, the crime rates to skyrocket, which he was like, that's crazy. I'm like, dude, like, you know, I think that's like something definitely like it's a huge problem in Baltimore and other inner cities. So like, I want to look more into that too, but I couldn't find that note. Just hella notes about Genkill.
To be continued on that issue.
Look at, seriously, this is from when we sent my notes. This is our Genkill shit.
Nice.
Oh, wait, is it? I got to clean my wallet. But yeah, we'll look, I think Carol. Anyways,
that's great.
We'll talk about that stuff later.
Yeah, man, more to come in this season.
Yeah, but it's a great, I'm excited, man.
Yeah.
Okay, it goes downhill from like,
no.
Should I be, I'll be disappointed.
No. but
I've watched the show before, everyone. It's just, it's hard for me to remember.
Me too. But yeah, so Nerys off the record tries to kind of course correct with Gus and Jeff Price. But then, you know, the next morning she's on her daily commute and finds out that she's front page news material when she buys a Baltimore Sun from none other than our friend Reginald.
Yeah. I love the Reginald.
Reginald
Dennis.
Bubbles.
Dennis. Not, yeah, he's on his like Dennis right now.
Yeah. From Bubbles. And he's going through a bit of a transformational experience. He's drying out in his sister's basement. He's been like over a year sober. He's kind of stuck in limbo there. Like David Simon kind of alluded to the fact that like stairs play like a big symbolic role throughout like all this series. And like, even though Bubbles is cleaning his act up, he's still like, you know, shunned to the basement lifestyle. Like, if you didn't know he was getting sober, like, he does a great job, Andre Arroyo, with his acting to convey, like, that, you know, he's got a lot of pent-up trauma with accidentally killing Sherrod, and, like, you know, things are a lot different from him, but, like, his living conditions still suggest, like, that of a junkie, but, like, the fact that he's not able to ascend the stairs to be with his sister and her kid and, like, be in a normal life, David Simon was kind of alluding, like, oh, he's, you know, stuck in between heaven and hell, you know, it's a thin line between heaven and
here. Damn, that's
good. He's stuck in limbo, so to speak, because his sister is, you know, keeping him away from the kitchen that he'll take to the pawn shop.
Yeah, that threshold, man. But my whole thing is, after he leaves out of that side basement door, does she then, she locks the stairs door,
right,
and before work, does she come down and lock the door from the outside with the key? Because I'm like, okay, but
right, right.
Who, do you hate your, like, your basement is just that worthless, you know, that you could just maybe leave it unlocked or, like, take whatever you want out of the basement, Bose? But I'm like, is this, like, a thing? Because, you know, I don't ever foresee myself having, like, a basement in my lifetime. It would seem kind of cool to have. So it's like, yeah, come on, like, gotta look out for the basement too, right? But I mean, I'm happy Reginald has a place to stay, but at the same time, it's like, oh, like, oh, someone else gonna, like, break in, and then Reginald will get blamed because she just went to work on her double shift and now the door's left open. It's like,
yeah, I think if they would have got the 13 episodes they deserved, we would have had a scene showing her, yeah, locking the downstairs basement.
He's like, I need 10 hours. Actually, I need 10 and a half because the basement, it needs, like, it needs to be locked.
Right.
Nah, good stuff. But here's a news question. Sorry, I know, like, you know, you brilliantly, you know, went over to Bubbles because he's selling old angry, salty Norris papers, but this is a dumb question, but Alma, she's, like, one of the only female reporters.
Right.
And is she supposed to, like, represent this young, like, cheaper hire for, you know, kind of making the case, like, ah, hey, you know, like, this is who's pushing out the people who actually know the city.
Yeah.
Or, I don't know.
And you're referencing Alma Gutierrez, played by Michelle Paris, who is married in real life to Lawrence Gillier Jr.
Larry. Right?
Who played D'Angelo. No, I don't know, man. Like,
no,
I mean, that whole evacuation kerfuffle, yeah, or debacle, whatever, where she used the wrong word and that, I think she's pretty sharp and, like, on it, and yeah, like, I don't think she represents,
like, they probably wouldn't be talking to her that way if she wasn't in, like, oh, you're, like, one of the reporters,
of
you
the
know
crew.
like get, yeah, your ass out, like, she's one of the boys, you know, it's like, it's like we went out to have a drink after, and
yeah,
you know, Scott's like, I don't want to be like this news, there's no news in this town.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, crazy stuff happens, but
it's not making national headlines.
Not like Chicago.
Yeah.
Is it that much better? Like, damn, I didn't know, like, Chicago. I mean, you've been there, so better news town?
I haven't been to Baltimore, so
yeah.
I like Chicago.
I've met people though, like, ah, you drive around three times, okay.
Yeah, but how much do we trust people's opinions about that?
I mean,
but so one thing that's brought up in, like, one of the staff meetings is about, like,
Sorry.
One thing that's brought up in the staff meetings is this thing about Johns Hopkins University, oh, and how there's, like, East Side Biopark, perhaps,
yeah,
maybe kind of affecting things in the co-op,
yeah, yeah,
sphere.
Yeah.
I mean, did you want to elaborate on a, yeah, little bit about, like, the real life connection that you, yeah, found?
Yeah, I mean, this is, like, I think I linked the wrong type of article because
I was able to find it and I did read it. So
that was BioPark. Is that the same thing as biotech? Is biotech a kind of like a subsidiary of the BioPark? Because in this article from 2001, which is about like Hopkins Biotech, which is apparently, you know, it's like, okay, so this is like, it's not an op-ed, but it's, you know, it's like more of a community, oriented report on biotech and its impact on the East Side, like what we're going to talk about with the co-op and Prop Joe. And this is from Urban Chronicle in 2001. So by this time though, they had already gotten rid of the poverty desk probably. Right. So this is like more of a fraud, fake trout, like nonprofit angle. it's like, as outlined by city officials and their consultants, Hopkins wouldn't own the park. A still to be created nonprofit development corporation would. There you go. The nonprofit. So basically it's like, you know, Hopkins would likely rent space in the park. And the idea behind the park is that its proximity to the medical complex would attract companies interested in capitalizing on Hopkins's research. So Hopkins, like one of the like top, or if not the top research university, I don't know where they're ranked now, but check out like at the top of the article, I shared, this is basically the lead, or is this, damn, I forgot my journalistic terms here. The nut graph. While Johns Hopkins struggled this week with the aftershocks of a 4-day federal ban on studies involving humans, many neighbors were not sorry that Hopkins got a comeuppance from the feds. This is the talk of the community. It's about time, said Glenn Ross, head of McElderry Park Community Association. Many in the community felt Hopkins was untouchable. It's like that little snafu with tests involving humans. Basically, apparently a healthy volunteer died in some medical testing.
Yeah. That's
so crazy. Yeah. And it's like, they're like, this is good, man. Cause like Hopkins finally got checked by the feds. Like they're out of control. This nonprofit shit is like running amok. Okay. Like some poor like person, maybe like, where are they getting these volunteers from? I mean, they are pushing into like pretty depressed areas of Baltimore, right? It's like, I really hope that, you know, I mean, it's sad whoever it was, but it's like,
right, yeah,
if it were someone like from the county, or if it's like, I'm not saying that they would matter less than like,
right,
oh, like we're kidnapping like kids from the hood. Okay, that's a whole different thing. But apparently, I mean, some people like from the Middle East Community Organization. Remember Middle East? It's Fallujah. So like, you think old slumlord Carcetti would give a shit about what's happening over there with biotech? No, whatever. Anyways, like basically they didn't all hate like that biotech's like, you know, coming into the East Side, but basically just to like sum it up, like the, here's just like another excerpt. Though Hopkins today supports dozens of community programs in East Baltimore, for years it literally walled itself off from its mostly black neighbors, descending from its trademark dome mainly when it needed to acquire property for expansion. So kind of sums up like its relationship. So good old legacy of Johns Hopkins. I still got to read like... There's this book called Ghosts of Johns Hopkins. So it's like one of the essential pieces from, you know, Baltimore by Antero Petila.
You brought up a lot of interesting stuff before on how there's some kind of underexplored corruption with the political influence of Johns Hopkins in the city, right?
Yeah. So. You'll have to refresh me, but I don't.
I mean, I just know you've talked about it before.
Oh, like taxes.
Yeah,
like, yeah, they're go. Yeah, you know, nonprofit baby. I mean, they're a private school, right? So,
and
I should know more. But.
Yeah. And also, they're kind of jeopardizing the territory of all these East Side drug dealers, which is a point of contention at the New Day co-op meeting that Marlo arrives late to after he, you know, provides a little decoy for the police by sending an attractive woman to a hotel room after patting her on the butt out in front.
Wow. Okay. I noticed all that.
This is I mean, we kind of got a glimpse of maybe Marlo making a play for the throne, so to speak, last season when he was like following around the Greeks, but now he's like almost kind of like openly insubordinate at the meeting with some of the elders trying to put him in check, and Slim Charles being suspicious of his intentions. So what do you think about all of that? Like
crazy
new game is constantly crazier than the old game, just the you know, open rebellion in this hotel conference room.
I mean, I appreciate Prop Joe's like geo drops, you know. He's they already got some stuff going on Route 40 and down Turner Station.
Yeah.
Chardine's from there. Other than that, I mean, you know, this is why I like Slim Charles. Is pretty much, you know, like everyone's avatar for the streets of Baltimore. He knows what's up. He's always kind of like level-headed and just, you know, knows what's up. But as far as like the more nuanced, like happenings of what's going on in that scene, honestly, I mean, you tell me, because I'm a little...
Well, Marlo,
like, I feel like I'm missing a lot.
Marlo is just saying that, you know, you're concerned about your own territory, right?
Yeah.
So you're just being like, self. But then Proposition Joe mentions a few other key players that would be affected by development, whose names I can't remember. I wish I did, because they're pretty memorable.
Like Hungry or...
Yeah. Turtle? No, that's Turtle Wells. I'm getting confused.
Yeah, that's who that she was robbing with.
But while Marlo's in the middle of that, he sends Chris off to the courthouse.
Oh yeah,
he runs into Rupert Bond and Rhonda Perlman and Cedric Daniels, and apparently Cedric Daniels has never seen a photo of him up until this point, like even though Bunk had brought him in at one point for the, you know, grand jury. Like
Chris has like a very like a lot of variety when it comes to his outfits. No,
sure. And then he's just able to walk out of there with the photo. Like he takes the photo of Sergey with the clerk not noticing, and is off on his merry way to go get some alliance. He's trying to make an alliance with the Greeks, I guess, and possibly reach out to Avon behind bars.
I mean, that can't be Trino with
the fat ass.
You know, it's like, isn't that kind of a theme? Like, not like either, if it's not the outright like kind of bribery taking place in these like you know, government city offices, just like outright, you know, like just incompetence or you know, it's like everything's crumbling, like look at the infrastructure of the city, like no one gives a shit, whatever,
right?
I mean, I'm sure they got copies of old Sergey just floating around. No, it's like, that's a rare find, man. It's crazy. It's like some random Ukrainian dude, not Russian, who, you know, it's like now in life, serving life.
Right.
Did he have a face? That's what she said when she like got the file. Like, no, he doesn't have a face. Where's the photo? Shit. Nah.
Let's see. We want to get into a little bit about the only two kid characters that are really being focused on anymore with Michael and Dookie.
Oh, yeah.
So what?
Yeah,
Let's.
yeah.
So Michael comes to check on Duquan's corner, and Spider and Kennard are pretty much being openly insubordinate
Yeah.
to Duquan
Well, it's
and.
Mike's corner, right? But
Right, but he's delegated like
yeah.
Duquan to,
Why?
yeah.
Why?
Right, so they're both basically being insubordinate, and Michael's kind of like, yeah, I get it. But at the same time, Kennard is
Yeah.
okay with like taking orders from Michael, even though he got like the
Yeah.
shit beat out of him by him.
Like brain hemorrhage is over. Like I'm surprised that he didn't have like a one bloodshot eye still.
Yeah, Jesus. So that's pretty interesting. The fractured family dynamic going on with Michael, Duquan, and Bug is pretty depressing beneath the surface because, you know, Duquan doesn't really have anything going for him. He's dropped out of school. They're at home playing Connect Four, like trying to maintain a facade of happiness. They're watching CSI. Is that maybe like a subtle diss on the part of David Simon that like other cop shows have quote unquote no value, even
Yeah.
though Simon alum Condi Alexander from Tremé in the Corner had a long-standing run on a CSI
Oh wow.
spinoff.
And then you were also making fun of Angela Schmoke? I don't know. Kurt Schmoke's daughter.
Oh, yeah.
You're like, "Oh, is that why like she's upset?" 'Cause like she had to work on CSI or something like NCIS. I don't know.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah,
They're all the
strays.
same.
Stray. Anyone can catch the strays, man. The gods will not save you.
They won't. They won't.
Oh shit.
But yeah, pretty sad situation going on here. Dookie seems more beaten down than ever. But damn, they grew up over like the
Yeah.
course of a season. It's pretty. I mean, I know like puberty and like, you know, growing out of adolescence is a thing that happens to everybody, but it's pretty neat that we get to watch that come to a fruition over like a season of television.
Yeah, I guess I've never described that as like a neat thing to watch, like kids going through puberty, but no, I know, like the like Mac Wilds, Jermaine Crawford, like really talented guys, and
It's just
they're
like
like coming into their own, they're like
it's like
doing their thing.
the passage of time. It's like kind of a trip sometimes.
Yeah, man, like we have had our own like transformation in like the almost 2 years that we've been doing. We'll be
But
done by the new year, maybe,
yeah.
probably, hopefully.
Yeah, I
Yeah.
think we will be. Anything
20,
else you want to
20,
talk about
22.
between Michael and Dookie and Bug and that
Dookie doesn't want to be a damn like au pair, like nanny. But I mean, it sounds pretty cool. Like, do whatever you want. Just pick up this kid from school and like I'll pay you straight cash. And yeah, people make fun of you, but it's like just Kennard, like what is he capable of? Oh wait, no.
Jesus. But I kind of like mentioned this when I was on the Twitter space with Rewired and some of the Wire
Oh
fans.
yeah. Tell us more about that.
But like we're trying to talk about like some of our favorite scenes, and like one of the scenes I mentioned was one that was fresh in my memory. It was when like Marlo, Chris, and Snoop drop by Michael, Dookie, and Bugs's house to like, you know, give him the lay of the land and say like, you know, Bodhi's Corner is now yours. Hey, where did you get that ring? Who did you have us kill for you? And it's like, it's not really like on the surface like a very dramatic scene or anything. Like it's just, you know, some business being sorted out. But then, like he's like openly admits that, you know, his little half brother's dad was brutally killed, like
Yeah.
potentially exposing him to like lifelong PTSD. And now like the situation with Michael, Dookie, and Bug, like, yeah, they're all like smiling and laughing now, but there's like so much under the surface of how like fucked up and dysfunctional this situation really is. And for some reason, like, this housing situation always, like, gives me, like, anxiety or something, or, like, I feel, like, tense watching it because, like, I'm just, like, you know, imagining the worst scenario possible for them. Yeah.
Super. That's sad, man. Sorry.
It is sad.
Yeah, like, bug. Hey, bro, what happened to my dad, dude? Like,
Jesus.
Just play Connect Four, man. It's gotten me through some tough times, and yeah. You know,
yeah,
like we played a lot at our like kind of stressful school growing up. Like,
yeah,
helped probably like with anxiety too. So
we can joyride around on my moped or yeah, whatever that is. Is that like
like a little Vespa?
Yeah. So what? That's like a big thing in Baltimore culture, or not like the.
I mean, I know the dirt bikes are, but wait, were you talking about the kids that work for Marlo, like the messengers? Or are you
That, and Mike has like a motorized bike vehicle in the apartment next to the TV or something.
Oh, nice.
I couldn't tell what it was, but
it's not like the 12 o'clock boys though, like dirt biking stuff, right?
Okay.
It's I don't remember it, so I'm asking you. But I mean, that's what like Meek Mill, you know, I know how you love all things Philly. Sorry if I'm like, do you like Meek Mill? No, I mean, it's very prevalent on like a lot of East Coast, like cities, like Northeast cities.
Yeah.
But, you know, like Meek Mill did that pretty like mediocre movie about the dirt bike kid. Charm City Kings. And then like,
I haven't seen
those are the kids that like Ed Norris is like, I don't give a shit. Like they're terrorizing our streets, like the Inner Harbor. Like, just, I don't care. Kill them, man.
Jeez.
But, we're talking about, like, I think if what's in the, like, living room or whatever TV room is similar to what the kid they're following, like, on Fulton when it's on the east side.
In air quotes.
Yeah, that's, like, maybe a throwback to the, Peanut King, like, his whole, you know, organization, you know. He would like have the little kids or, you know, like the drug dealers rode around on those type of like little Vespa, like motorbike, moped type things through all the alleys around East Baltimore and stuff as like a means of transportation. And I think I talked about that. Like he got out of jail like a few years ago after being in there for hella long, since like the 80s. And then a guy like who was older came up to him. He's like, oh, look, dude, like this scar is from a tailpipe of my little mini like moped that I used to ride around when I worked in like your organization. Like it burned me. Look, it's my scar. And he's like, oh, that's crazy.
Yeah.
Like, flashback. Wanna play Connect Four? Nah.
Oh, that's really interesting stuff there. I like, yeah, because I like remember maybe from Truth Be Told, I talked about like how it's a big part of like the Baltimore culture.
Yeah, man, let's go see some. No, we can't.
Yeah. But anyway, one thing we didn't touch on is that Herc is working for Levy now, and he put one big mystery to rest as to why he talks the way he does. His New York accent. He's talking about like, oh, Baltimore Orioles isn't paying their pitcher. I should have stayed in the Bronx. So it's like,
yeah,
finally.
There you go, man.
We can pin it down. But yeah, somebody at the newsroom says at one point, I wonder what it's like to write for a real newspaper. McNulty says something similar. I wonder what it's like to work in a real police department. And I kind of share some of the same sentiments myself. You know, I wonder what it's like to record a real podcast. All right.
Nice. All right. So, hey, hit us up on social media. Gods Will Not Save You. Twitter, Instagram, Facebook still.
Yeah, you're
still doing it? Oh, you're a trooper. Without Willie, we'd be nothing. I mean, like, don't put yourself down because You're the only one really participating in
now
this.
You post some good stuff too. It's great.
On Twitter.
Yeah. Also, if you want to reach out to us, you have any questions, comments, and concerns, thegodswillnotsaveyou@gmail.com. We'll be happy to talk with you.
All right.
Thanks, everybody.
Talk to you next episode.